Next case this morning is Wernsing against Thompson. Mr. Light.
May it please the court, Eric Light, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of Defendant Appellant Odell Thompson, the former Inspector General of the Illinois Department of Human Services. This case arises out of Mr. Thompson's attempt to maintain control over the Office of Inspector General, which is a watchdog agency that the Governor of Illinois appointed Mr. Thompson to run. A few months after his appointment, Mr. Thompson received two cryptic emails from the plaintiffs, who were investigators in the office's Southern Bureau. They demanded a meeting with Mr. Thompson to discuss unspecified concerns over an unnamed individual.
How many people in that office are policymakers?
In the Office of Inspector General?
It's all the
inspectors and their supervisors.
Are policymakers?
Yes.
That certainly does make it hard to control then, right? If they're all policymakers?
Well, yes.
Are you really contending they all make policy?
All chiefs and no Indians?
Well, they certainly all have...
Usual bureaucracy.
They certainly have the ability, the inherent power to affect the implementation of policy on very significant matters. For example, the investigators... They make recommendations on individual cases of abuse or neglect of residents of facilities operated by Department of Human Services. Those recommendations are, you know, they go into the Inspector General's final decision on those individual cases. They are also empowered.
Those involve a political point of view?
No, not a political point of view, Your Honor, but what our position is that the investigators... That loyalty to the Inspector General's policies is a legitimate employment criteria.
Well, everybody in the bureaucracy is supposed to be loyal to the policies of the chief, aren't they?
But in this case, the investigators have meaningful input into those policies, or at least the implementation of those policies. For example, not only do they make factual findings on individual cases, they have the power to make recommendations for corrective action that the facility must take if there is a substantiated finding of abuse or neglect. That can include things like recommending additional training, add a policy, rescind a policy, those sorts of things. Furthermore, the Inspector General himself makes recommendations based on what the investigators give to him. They make recommendations to the Secretary of the Department of Human Services, and those recommendations can include up to closure of a facility. And I would submit to the court that a closure of a facility would certainly be something that would, you know, that certainly goes to the policy of preventing abuse and neglect of mentally ill.
The policy is they have to be honest and competent, but I mean, I'm not sure why that makes them a policymaker.
Well, as I said, because they have the input on how the Inspector General makes his decisions, how he makes his recommendations to effectuate the overall policy of avoiding abuse and neglect of these individuals in state facilities. And indeed, if the Inspector General were to recommend closure of a facility, and there was a closure based on his recommendation, that could certainly lead to that could be a big deal in some of these areas, especially where, you know, jobs are scarce and people they don't want to lose their livelihood. In addition, the investigators not only make recommendations on individual cases, they not only make recommendations for corrective action that facilities should take, they also make recommendations on the investigatory procedures of the Office of Inspector General. And I submit that that's another indication that they are policymakers. They have influence on the office's policies. Given that they are policymakers, Mr. Thompson could legitimately require these individuals to obtain his advance approval before speaking out on office policies or operations. The law is clear that policymakers may be fired.
Counsel, let me raise a question that has been bugging me but isn't discussed in your brief, which is whether we have a case or controversy. There's certainly no controversy going forward. Thompson's out of office. His predecessor disavows his directives. And if one looks backward, I have some difficulty identifying any injury that's being alleged. The plaintiffs weren't punished in their jobs, that is, they weren't demoted, they didn't lose any salary. What is the case or controversy here?
Well, I guess I would be making their argument for them, which is that...
This is a subject that both sides have to worry about, as indeed the judge has to worry about. So here we go.
I think the case or controversy is that, at least for, say, for example, Ms. Wernsing, she says that she was not able to speak out on certain policies.
She was perfectly able to speak out. As no one went up to her and put a gag on, she wasn't chained to the wall. Right? The normal way this kind of thing arises is if somebody speaks out and then there's punishment of some kind. But so far as I can tell, that didn't happen. And it seems we're being asked for an advisory opinion on whether what somebody didn't say but might have said would have been protected by the First Amendment had it been said. Although, of course, since nobody spoke out, we don't know what it would have been. That certainly does pose problems under Article 3, does it not?
I think they're claiming that this is a prior restraint, that it prevented them from speaking out. That they
it did not prevent them from speaking out. Their mouths remained operable at all times, right? At most, it threatened something if they spoke out, like what? Demotion?
Well,
although, since in your view, everybody in the agency is a policymaking employee, it's hard to see how they could be demoted. You'd still be a policymaker. Anyway, right? That's the normal way in which this thing arises. Somebody says something, and then there's some response.
That is the normal way it arises. Now, my understanding, which perhaps is...
If somebody wants to complain about what they call a prior restraint and it's still in force, you get an injunction. But, of course, there seems to be no prospective controversy.
That's true.
Because there's no instruction in force.
Well,
I have never heard of a case, maybe you know of one, maybe the plaintiffs know of one, in which damages were awarded for an email saying shut up when nobody then spoke out and there was no response within the bureaucracy. I don't know of any case ever awarding damages in such a circumstance. Judges think it's appropriate for injunctions and not damages. And injunctions aren't available here because this is no longer the policy, if it ever was. That's why I'm trying to figure out whether we've got a case or controversy.
Well, Your Honor, I thought there was a case or controversy. The plaintiffs say they felt that they could not have spoken out, that they felt that it prevented them, that it prohibited them, not that they couldn't physically speak out, but that they were barred by this.
Oh, look, now, can we all use language in a perfectly normal way? Nobody was barred. Nobody was gagged. Nobody was taken to Guantanamo and put in an isolation cell. Right? What happened here was, in the way most favorable to the plaintiffs, Thompson said that if you do this, then I may do something to you. It's a rather different thing from putting you in an isolation cell and not allowing you to talk to the outside world.
That's true, Your Honor. Yeah. I suppose what I can do is offer to you know, submit a supplemental filing if you'd like. That's the best.
Perhaps that would be a good idea for both sides. And I will give you 10 days.
Thank you, Your Honor.
to address the question whether we have a case or controversy. Perhaps one might pursue the question whether damages have been awarded in the past for a bureaucratic directive that was never violated, never led to any response, no loss of salary, no discipline, no... Right? I mean, I hope you all see my problem. It's awfully hard to figure out whether any speech that might have occurred in violation of this directive would have been protected by the First Amendment when none of it took place, and we're therefore being asked a completely abstract and hypothetical question.
Okay. Well, I agree there. I'm not aware of any cases.
10 days.
Okay, thank you. Where there was this sort of claim, and assuming there is...
Is there a claim for damages here at all?
On the prior restraint or retaliation?
Either one.
Yes, there's a claim for damages. For example, Mr. Bingaman claims that he was denied promotion in retaliation for him sending this email. Turning to the retaliation issue, there are two instances of speech that the plaintiffs claim led to Mr. Thompson's alleged retaliation against them. These emails and Ms. Warrenson's inquiry about the meaning of Mr. Thompson's directive. These claims fail because neither of these instances of speech was speech on a matter of public concern. Emails were extremely vague. They didn't say what the concerns were. They didn't even identify who the concerns were about. They said nothing about incompetence, fraud, wrongdoing of anyone. They didn't say anything about there being a danger to any residents of the department's facilities if this unidentified individual was made their supervisor. In fact, the clearest thing about the emails was their threat to go over
How
Mr.
Thompson. If we think of the only real speech as these two emails sent to Thompson, how is the question whether they are even covered by the First Amendment, given Connick? I mean, how is that related to the pending Supreme Court case of Garcetti against Sabalos? And are these kinds of comments, is the argument similar here to those arguments that are before the Supreme Court in Garcetti?
I apologize, Your Honor. I'm not familiar with that case.
Okay, go ahead.
These emails do not serve the purposes for which courts have granted constitutional protection for employee speech. If they had been disseminated to the public, they wouldn't have told the public anything really about what was going on in the office. They would not have informed the public about wrongdoing. They would not have allowed the public to make any sort of more informed decision than if they hadn't ever read the emails. In addition, the form of the emails is a private internal communication. This is indicative, again, that they're not speech on a matter of public concern. And they came in the context of a reorganization of the entire office, where people in the office, investigators, were concerned about their own positions and how this might affect them. So this all suggests, again, that the emails were not speech on a matter of public concern. And indeed, ruling in favor of the plaintiffs on this would potentially transform much routine interoffice communication into fodder for constitutional litigation. That's not necessarily bad, but in this case, where that speech doesn't promote the values that give rise to constitutional protection, then that's not something that should be promoted. Plaintiffs say that Mr. Thompson had a duty to investigate their emails. They rely on Waters versus Churchill. That case, of course, is distinguishable because in that case, the question was, what did the plaintiff say? And there was some dispute about what the plaintiffs had said. Here, of course, it's perfectly clear what the plaintiff said. It's written down in the emails, and there's no question that Mr. Thompson read the emails and he knew what they said, so there's nothing for him to investigate. They say it was obvious that what they wanted to address, even though they didn't say it, that what they wanted to address was speech, something on a matter of public concern. But it wasn't obvious. It could have been many different things that weren't matters of public concern. They could have been concerned that this unidentified individual had too harsh a management style. Perhaps they thought that he was rude. Maybe they thought that he didn't fit in with the culture of the Southern Bureau. Maybe they wanted one of their own friends to be promoted to this position. It could have been any of these things. So it certainly wasn't obvious that they were trying to raise a matter of public concern. And the fact that they wanted to engage in speech on a matter of public concern at their hoped-for meeting doesn't help them, because the Constitution protects speech, not the thoughts that they keep in their head unspoken to anyone. I'd like to touch briefly on the qualified immunity issue, assuming the court gets to it in the prior restraint. There are the issue I'd like to address is whether or not these individuals were policymakers. And I think Thompson acted reasonably in believing that they were policymakers, given this court's two decisions, one in Hudson and one in Matlock.
Both You're of which relying on Hudson, is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. These are two decisions.
Do you think this situation is really in any way analogous to Hudson, which involved Chicago politics? I mean, the political elements there are pretty obvious, but very obvious here.
I think there's some ways in which it's less indicative of policymaker, but there are also ways in which it's more indicative of policymakers. Clearly, Chicago Finance Committee is more inherently political than the Office of Inspector General. On the other hand, the investigators in this case, they do not just gather facts. They go ahead and they have the power to make recommendations on things that do affect policy. As I was saying, they can make recommendations on how a facility should respond to findings of abuse or neglect. And the Inspector General can rely on those recommendations in making his own recommendation up to and including closure of the facility. They make recommendations on OIG investigatory
policies.
Suppose
they weren't policymakers. Is this kind of a broad prohibition? Is it clear that that's unconstitutional, or is that...
Well, the prohibition was against speaking out on office policies or operations. I think it's clear that a top policymaker is entitled to tell his policymaking subordinates that they can't...
I said assume they're not policymakers.
Oh, assume they're not. I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay. Then what happened?
Well, if they're not policymakers, then yes, I think that it would be unconstitutional for a top policymaker to say, no, you can't speak out on any office policy.
Well, would it be reasonable to think anything else but that? That's the
for policymakers as well?
Hmm?
Mean, for policymakers as well?
No, I'm talking about non-policy. We don't have much law on this subject, so I'm curious as to you know what would be a reasonable conclusion for someone to make about a prior restraint in this context.
If they're not policymakers, I think Mr. Thompson would be reasonable to think that they shouldn't speak out on policies in a way which would undermine the mission of the office.
Even if he made one of these broad statements, don't talk to anybody about basically anything. I mean, what's not covered by policy or operations? That covers pretty much the whole ball of wax, doesn't it?
Well, no. An operation, for example, the plaintiffs say an operation would include an abuse of office. And so our position is that it doesn't include abuse of office, that an OIG operation is really what is the OIG there to do? It's there to investigate and make findings and make recommendations. That's OIG operation. If someone is abusing their office, that's not an OIG operation, and it wouldn't be covered by the directive. I see that I have less than a minute left. I'd like to reserve. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Whitney.
Thank you. Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Your Honor, since it was obviously the case or controversy issue was of great concern, perhaps it's best I start by addressing that. First of all, with respect to the retaliation claims, I would submit the record makes very clear that there is a live case or controversy. The record does show that following the transmission of these emails to the defendant, there was a pattern of hostile adverse employment actions affecting, in particular, plaintiffs Wernsing and Bingaman. These included unfavorable performance evaluations, denial of promotion to Mr. Bingaman. There were some lesser actions, denial of travel vouchers, denial of overtime, and this is well laid out. So I think it's very clear that under the retaliation part of the claim, at a minimum, that we do indeed have a live case or controversy. With respect to the prior restraint claim, admittedly, we did not address that, of course, since appellant did not raise the issue. And
I don't know why you say since appellant did not raise the issue. Whether there is a case or controversy is an issue for every party at every stage of the litigation.
I understand. I understand.
As indeed courts are required to ask this on their own, whether any party does it or not.
Right. I'm simply explaining why we didn't brief that, but I appreciate that. And certainly we'd be happy to comply with the 10-day requirement. Do you want that in the form of a supplemental brief or?
Supplemental memorandum.
Supplemental memo. Okay. All right. With respect to the qualified immunity issue on retaliation itself, the defendant's argument is that the emails themselves.
And by the way, if since I raised this with Mr. Light, if either side wants to add to this memorandum any commentary on how the issues here relate to the issues before the Supreme Court in the Garcetti case, please do. It's Garcetti against Sabalos. Cert was granted on February 28th.
Will do, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
With respect, again, to the core of the retaliation claim, defendant's argument that the emails themselves did not communicate the specific nature of the concerns they wanted to raise, and that this somehow proves that the plaintiffs were not raising a matter of concern, I would submit as a red herring. The plaintiffs were retaliated against because they sought to raise a matter of public concern, and this court has repeatedly stated that the point of the speech in question and the speaker's motive are entitled to great weight in determining whether the speaker was raising a matter of public concern. And in effect, what happened here is the defendant responded to an earnest request to communicate with a sledgehammer, taken not only to these plaintiffs but to all of his employees' First Amendment rights. And now he wants this court to indulge his argument. Well, how could he have known they were trying to raise a matter of public concern? I would submit, Your Honors, that an employee who attempts to respect and follow the chain of command, the internal mechanisms to resolve important issues, should not automatically be treated less favorably than the individual who immediately turns to the press or to a public forum or to a legislator. And ironically, what the plaintiff sought to do was the very thing that the defendant later ordered them to do, respect the chain of command and raise issues in-house before resorting to external agents, as his directive put it, to address issues pertaining to the operation of the agency.
I'd like to ask a question about this meeting in 2001 where the chief met with the people, the plaintiffs here. Was that issue raised in the district court at all?
Meaning I'm not quite sure if I understand.
Well, we're talking about public concern. I think when they had the meeting, of course, they discussed the matter that was a public concern. So there's an argument that that is what we're concerned about, and that's what gave rise to it legitimates the lawsuit here. But the answer to that apparently is that meeting was not raised in the litigation in the district court. Is that right or wrong?
The specific argument that if the emails did not sufficiently inform the defendant of the nature of the public concern means that they were not raising a matter of public concern. We did raise a new argument that that there at least it would not apply to any retaliation after March 1st, 2001, when he was very...
My question is, was that presented to the district court?
That it was not presented to the district court because the argument that it was in response to was not raised in the district court. So you are correct. It is to some extent a new argument, but only in response to a new argument that was presented to us, in essence. However, I would also like to point out in this regard that there is additional evidence that Defendant Thompson was aware of the underlying concern about the emails even prior to this March 2001 meeting. In the deposition of Sandra Mott at pages 65 and 66, she indicates that she had a conversation with Defendant Thompson at approximately the same time. It's not clear if it was immediately before or immediately after the emails were sent, in which he asked her, what was this all about? And so he did know prior to the retaliatory acts being taken, or at least there's evidence that he did know, and it raises a material issue of fact in that regard. Your Honors, central inquiry in these cases is the point of the speech in question, as this court articulated in Smith v. Fruin and in innumerable cases cited in our brief that were cited in Smith v. Fruin. And also the motive of the speech is also important. And if we consider these elements of the test in the context of this case, it's very clear that the plaintiff sought to raise matters of public concern. They were concerned about a prospective appointment of a new bureau chief who had previously served in the position of bureau chief temporarily and had been a disaster for the agency, with the case logs just stockpiling. Cases weren't being processed within the legal time frame that was allowed, where they were required to be processed. There were all kinds of employment issues that caused investigators to leave the agency, further impacting the efficiency of the agency. So clearly the underlying speech was raising matters of public concern, and that was their point.
You say clearly, that's one reason why I want both sides to address Garcetti against Sabalos. The main argument that's being made in that case, as I understand it, is that line of argument would essentially overrule Connick, because the main reason why people complain about personnel issues within public agencies is because an efficiently run public agency serves the public better than an inefficiently run public agency, and therefore arguments about the efficiency of running the public agency must concern the public. And that's what the Ninth Circuit held. It's effectively what you're asking us to hold. And the contrary argument is that if that's true, the Connick must be incorrect. So it seems to me, maybe this is wrong, that you're asking us to adopt the precise argument that the Ninth Circuit adopted in Garcetti and which led the Supreme Court to grant certiorari. Now, maybe that's wrong, but one reason why I would like both sides to address this issue.
Understandably, Your Honor, I would say, however, that I believe that the nature of the issues that the employees wanted to raise in this case go beyond even the efficiency of the agency, because they also extend to such things as whether or not legal requirements were being met. So clearly the potential impact was far greater. I see that I have little time. Let me just summarize that in response to this argument on retaliation, I think Waters does show that an employer has a duty to make a reasonable inquiry, not simply when the speech presented is vague, as defendant submits, but they have a broader duty to show reasonable care in making employment decisions that implicate.
I don't understand how the federal constitution give state bureaucrats a duty of inquiry or a duty of reasonable care.
When presented...
It would be nice to think that under the U.S. Constitution there are no incompetent bureaucrats. But whatever is in the Constitution, it was not a guarantee of competence within a bureaucracy.
Understood, Your Honor. But I think the limiting factor here is that in the context of when an employer is presented May I conclude my sentence?
Please.
Presented with a issue that has clear potential to raise and implicate First Amendment concerns, that then they are under a duty to exercise reasonable care in making an inquiry to determine that. And I think Waters does stand for
I'd
that
like
proposition.
I'd like to ask you one question about the prior restraint issue. Is it your position that this restraint would have been unconstitutional even if these inspectors were not policymakers?
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor, because then it comes out under a blanket prior restraint like you see in the case of NTEU, for example. I think that then it's very clear that an employer cannot impose this kind of blanket restriction, saying that anything dealing with the operations of this agency cannot be divulged outside of the agency unless you clear it with me first. It's very similar to the pre-clearance directive in Crew v. Aiken, which this court decided a few months ago, I believe, involving the University of Illinois. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Whitney. Mr. Heller.
May it please the court. My name is Brian Heller. I represent the plaintiff, Jenny Wernsing. I'd like to take up from the point that Mr. Whitney left off regarding the relevance of the Waters versus Churchill decision on the issue of the matter of public concern. We know that under Connick and Pickering that the employer has to make a decision regarding the speech, and under the law, in making a decision of whether it's public concern, there are these factors of the content, the context, the motive, and the court has to decide what facts are to be looked at to determine the employer's liability. Is it the facts that, as the employer just totally subjectively believed them to be, whether in good faith or not? Are they the facts as a jury would decide them, or some other standard? And I think it's clear that Waters v. Churchill's tried to set a middle standards there to say that the governmental employer has to act reasonably in ascertaining the facts. And whether I think Judge Easterbrook's comments go to Justice Scalia's dissent, who had some concern about this reasonableness standard, but some standard has to be imposed, and that it's clear from the plurality decision and the opinion that controlled in Waters that this broader rule that the employer must use care that a reasonable manager would use before making an employment decision. And a reasonable manager would not, in having some employees asked to speak to him about a subject, immediately begin retaliating against them, having no knowledge of what they wanted to talk to him about. And in fact, while brief, Mr. Thompson has suggested various conclusions that he might have been able to draw from the facts as he knew them. In fact, there's very little testimony about any conclusions he drew. His testimony was he didn't know what this was about at all. That's his testimony. And so from a level of complete ignorance, he then began a pattern of retaliation. Now, that in no way fits a way a reasonable employer would act.
Let me get this straight. What you're saying is that if a subordinate sends the inspector general an email with a single sentence and it says, go to hell, that there is a duty of investigation that creates, because perhaps you would have learned that the person who sent that email was a fundamentalist minister who was concerned that the operation of the state government was intruding on certain religious views, and so on, and it was actually protected by the First Amendment, and that failure to do that might violate the Free Exercise Clause, something like that?
No, I wouldn't maintain that position at all, because...
I'm back to this business about investigation, then. You have an email that on its face does not seem to be a form of protected speech under established doctrine. And perhaps if you investigated, you might learn that there was something interesting behind it. But where does the duty of investigation come from? If there's no investigation in my hypothetical, why would there be a duty here?
Well, the duty to investigate, and this is something I think that, and I'm glad you asked that, because the way the defendants puts the issue is we're imposing some sort of duty on them. We're not imposing a duty other than if you want to engage in punishment of this person for making a very innocuous and good faith question under the Constitution, before you go off on some irrational behavior of punishing these people, you should make at least some reasonable inquiry as to what they wanted to talk about. Now, if somebody approaches...
Then you ought to answer my hypothetical, yes. You need to investigate why this person is saying that, what their reason was, and how they would follow it up if you engaged in a conversation with them.
Well,
you can't have these things both ways. Either you believe that this is in the First Amendment or it isn't.
Well, a question or a statement, "Go to hell," is on its face a disruptive statement in the workplace that doesn't give any indication on its face that the employee wants to convey any useful information. Whereas, quite to the contrary, in our circumstance,
I must say there are many religiously oriented people over the years who think that that statement conveys a very great deal of useful information.
Well, not as far as
you are going to spend eternity is of interest to most people.
I understand what you're saying, but approaching this from a more practical matter of how, again, we're not Waters versus Churchill doesn't impose this overwhelming duty to
find any duty to investigate in any of the opinions in Waters. I mean, Justice O'Connor's opinion for I think three justices talks about some general reasonableness requirement. But where's the duty to investigate?
Well, the duty to investigate comes upon the assumptions that you're going to, the reasonable assumptions you're going to make. And you cannot, in some circumstances, as her opinion points out, you might be able to come to conclusions.
You may or may not be aware that this kind of question comes up all the time under the Fourth Amendment, which has an express reasonableness requirement. And people then say, well, the police, even though they've got probable cause, have a duty to conduct more investigation in order to be reasonable. And we always say no, that there's no such requirement. Why would things be different under the First Amendment?
Well, the issue here, again, is a pattern of retaliatory acts that on their face are irrational. Irrational retaliation against a simple request to transmit information to this governmental employer. I think it's a completely different type of situation. I'm going to get back to your question of, Justice O'Connor was saying is that certainly in some circumstances there need not be an investigation depending on all the facts that are at hand, but in other situations there may be some kind of investigation necessary. In fact, there had been an investigation which occurred in the Churchill case, which her opinion found to be adequate. And I would note that in Justice Souter's concurring opinion that he points out that Justice's O'Connor's rationale was the controlling rationale for the court and should apply to additional or to future cases. I would like to address the question that was raised about the March meeting, and the judge is correct that was the issue of the March meeting was not specifically raised as an argument below, but of course this court can rely on anything that the record supports to affirm the district court's ruling. And, of course, the district court had that fact in front of it, as far as we know, in coming to its conclusion, may well have relied on those facts. With one other issue I'd like to address with respect to the public concern is I do think that there's some analogy here between this case and the Eberhardt case, where the court bypassed the public concern question and went right to the fact that this was protected speech and that the writing of the novel was protected speech, no matter what relationship it might have had to the employment, and the employer could not just gratuitously punish the employee for having written that novel. That is the rationale there, saying the employer here cannot simply gratuitously punish the employees for asking a question about the policy, or Mrs. Wernzing, who asked a question about, well, what does this policy mean? And then she was further retaliation was made against her. So for all of those reasons, we would ask the court to affirm the decision of the district court. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. Anything further, Mr. Light?
The debate in the district court over the speech was, are these emails protected speech or not? That's how the district court understood the issue, and that's how it analyzed the issue, not whether or not the speech at the March 2001 meeting was the protected speech. In addition, now counsel says that this court can affirm on any basis in the record. Well, let's take a look at the record. In their depositions, the plaintiffs said repeatedly that what they are complaining about is they believe that Mr. Thompson retaliated against them for their emails. They did not mention the March 2001 meeting, so the record doesn't support them either. As for duty to investigate, I just like to point out that top administrators like Mr. Thompson are busy people. They get tons of emails every day, letters, calls, faxes. They have meetings. They have to read reports. To impose this sort of a duty to investigate is just not reasonable. We ask that this court reverse the district court and direct entry of judgment in favor of Mr. Thompson. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.